Chapter 23. The Piano Problem. The piano was thought to have been invented by Bartolomeo Cristofori in the early 18th century, and was originally called the Gravicembalo col Piano e Forte, which was fortunately reduced to Pianoforte, then more simply to Piano. Composed of 550 pounds of iron, wood, strings, and felt, the 88-key instrument is capable of the subtlest of melodies, yet stored up in the tension strings is the destructive power of a subcompact moving at 20 miles per hour. If jurisfiction was the policing agency inside books and the Council of Genres was the political arm, Text Grand Central was the bureaucracy that bridged the two. Right up until the ultra-word debacle, TGC had remained unimpeachably honest, but after that, the Council of Genres, on my advice, took the harsh but only possible course of action to ensure that Text Grand Central would be too inefficient and unimaginative to pose a threat. They appointed a committee to run it. As we walked onto one of the main story code engine floors, I heard Thursday Five gasp. The proportions of the room were more in keeping with a factory that made very large things, and the stone walls, vaulted ceilings, and flickering gas lamps betrayed the room's provenance as something borrowed from an unpublished Gothic horror novel. Laid in serried ranks across the echoing vastness of the space were hundreds of story code engines, each one the size of a bus and built of shiny brass, mahogany, and cast iron. A convoluted mass of pipes, valves, and gauges, they looked like a cross between an espresso machine, a ship's engine, and a euphonium on acid. They were so large, there was a catwalk running around the upper section for easy maintenance, with a cast iron spiral staircase at one end for access. "These are imagino-transference story code engines, the most important piece of technology we possess. Remember the pipe leading out of the core of containment in Pinocchio?" Thursday Five nodded. "The throughput is radiated across the intra-genre nothing and ends up here, where they are then transmitted into the reader's imagination." I knew why it worked, but not how. Indeed, I was suspicious that perhaps there wasn't an explanation at all, or indeed, any need for one. It was something we called an abstract narrative imperative. They work solely because it's expedient that they do. The book world is like that, full of wholly improbable plot devices that are there to help grease the storytelling cogs. I paused so they could both watch the proceedings for a moment. Thursday Five made no secret of her fascination, but Thursday 1 through 4 stifled a faux yawn. Despite this, she still looked around. It was hard not to be impressed. The machines stretched off into the hazy distance, almost as far as you could see. Technicians scurried like ants over the whirring machinery, checking dials, oiling, venting off steam, and filling out reports on clipboards. Others moved between machines, with trolleys full of papers to be filed, and the air was full of the smell of hot oil and steam. Above our heads, a series of clanking shafts and flapping leather belts brought power to the engines, and the combined clatter and hum in the vast chamber sounded like a cascading waterfall. 500 machines on each floor, I shouted above the tumult, with each one capable of handling up to 50,000 concurrent readings. The ones in the blue overalls are the story code technicians, known affectionately as word monkeys. They keep the engines running smoothly, clean out the dialogue injectors, and make sure there isn't a build-up of irony on the compressors. The man dressed in the white lab coat is the text collector. There is a reader echo that pings back to the engine to throughput the next word, so we can use that to check if the book is running true to the author's original wishes. Any variance is termed a textual anomaly and is caught in the wastegate of the echo skimmers, which are those large copper things on the top. This is all really fascinating technological stuff, observed Thursday 1 through 4 dryly, but I'm waiting to see how it relates to pianos. It doesn't, oh sarcastic one. It's called education. Pointless exposition, if you ask me. She's not asking you, retorted Thursday 5. Exactly, I replied. And some people enjoy the techie stuff. Follow me. I opened an arched oak door that led off the engine floor and into the administrative section of Text Grand Central, a labyrinth of stone corridors lit by flaming torches affixed to the walls. It was insufferably gloomy, but economical, part of the unfinished Gothic horror novel from which all the TGC was fashioned. As soon as the door closed, the noise from the main engine floor ceased abruptly. I was just trying to explain, I said, how we find out about narrative flexations. Most of the time, the anomalies are just misreads and lazy readers getting the wrong end of the stick. But we have to check everything, just in case. I can get this on the Text Grand Central tour for 20 shillings and with better company, said Thursday 1 through 4, looking pointedly at Thursday 5. I'm interested, ma'am. Creep. Slut. What did you call me? Hey! I shouted. Cut it out! She started it, said Thursday 1 through 4. I don't care who started it. You'll both be fired if you carry on like this. They fell silent, and we walked along the echoing corridors, past endless oak doors, all relating to some textual activity, such as word meanings, idea licensing, and grammar site control. The problem with pianos, I began, is that there aren't enough to go round. Lots of people in the book world play them. They frequently appear in the narrative, and they're often used as plot devices. Yet for an unfathomable reason that no one can fully explain, there are only 15 to cover the entire book world. 15? Snorted Thursday 1 through 4, who was lagging behind in a petulant manner. How do they manage that, then? With a lot of difficulty. Have a look. I opened a door off the corridor. The room was much like a psychiatrist's office, full of bookshelves and diplomas on the wall. There were two chairs, a desk, and a couch. Two men were sitting in the chairs. A beard and pipe identified the first immediately as a psychiatrist, and the second, who seemed desperately nervous, was obviously the patient. "So, Mr. Patient," began the psychiatrist, "what can I do for you?" "Well, Doc," muttered the patient unhappily, "I keep on thinking I'm a dog." "I see. And how long has this been going on?" "Since I was a puppy." "Excuse me," I interrupted, "I'm looking for the piano squad." "This is very old jokes," explained the psychiatrist apologetically. "Pianos are down the corridor, first on the left." "Sorry," I muttered, somewhat sheepishly, and quietly closed the door. "I keep on doing that," I murmured. "They should really label these doors better." We walked along the corridor, found the correct door, and opened it to reveal a room about 50 feet square. The walls were roughly plastered, and the vaulted stone ceiling was supported in the center of the room by a sturdy pillar. Set into the wall to our right was an aperture the size of a single garage, painted bright white and illuminated from within by several hundred light bulbs. As we watched, there was a faint buzz, a flicker, and an ornate cabinet piano suddenly appeared in the aperture. Almost instantly, a workman dressed in brown overalls and with a flat cap moved forward to wheel it out on well-oiled casters. Facing the bright white opening was a control desk that looked like a recording studio's mixing console, and behind this were two men of youthful countenance dressed in linen suits. They were wearing headsets and had the harried look of people under great pressure. "Upright Rosewood returned from Sons and Lovers," whispered the one who was standing. "Stand by to send the Getzman into Villette." "Check!" shouted the other man as he adjusted the knobs and sliders on the console. The workman pushed a Getzman Grand into the empty aperture, stepped back, called, "Clear!" and with another buzz, the piano vanished. They looked at us as soon as we entered, and I nodded a greeting. They nodded one back and returned to their work. "Observe," I said to the Thursdays, pointing to a large indicator panel on the wall behind the men. The 15 pianos were listed down the left-hand side, and in columns next to them were indicator lights and illuminated panels that explained what was happening to each. The uppermost piano on the list, we noted, was a generic grand and was currently inside Bleak House. It would be available in a few minutes, and was next due to appear in Mill on the Floss, where it would stay for a number of scenes until departing for Heart of Darkness. While we watched, the indicator boards clicked the various changes as the two operators expertly moved the pianos back and forth across fiction. Below the indicator boards were several other desks, a water cooler, and a kitchenette and coffee bar. There were a few desultory potted plants kicking around, but aside from several rusty filing cabinets, there was not much else in the room. 15 pianos is usually ample, I explained, and when all pianos are available for use, the piano squad just trots along merrily to a set timetable. There are a few changes here and there when a new book requires a piano, but it generally works. 86% of pianos appear in 19th and early 20th century literature. I pointed to the indicator board. But if you notice, 8 pianos are status unavailable, which means that they have been pulled out of the frontline service for maintenance. I waved the report Bradshaw had handed me. There was an administrative mix-up. We usually have 1 piano offline at a time, but some clot had them all refitted at once to save costs. The Thursdays looked at the two operators again. And as we watched, the upright piano, made of rosewood and with inlaid brass, was moved from Sons and Lovers to the Mayor of Casterbridge, and then on to the Turn of the Screw. "That's right," I said. "Charles and Roger are having to spread 7 pianos around the entire canon of English fiction. Hang on. It looks as though we're coming to a break." They did indeed seem to be about to stop work for a few minutes. The two operators relaxed, stopped what they were doing, removed their headsets, and stretched. "Hello, Thursday," said the younger of the two in a quiet whisper. "Brought your family into work?" "Not a chance," I laughed. "Juris Fiction Cadets Thursday 5 and Thursday 1 through 4. Meet Charles and Roger of the piano squad." "Hello!" yelled Roger, who appeared not to be able to converse at anything less than a shout. "Come up and have a look-see!" The Thursdays went to join Roger at the console. Thursday 5 because she was genuinely interested, and Thursday 1 through 4 because Roger was actually quite attractive. "Just how many piano mentions are there in fiction?" asked Thursday 5.
"Thousands," he replied, "but in varying degrees. Much of 19th century literature, the Brontes, Hardy and Dickens in particular, is literally awash with pianos, but they're rarely played. Those are the easy ones to deal with. Our pianos, 1 to 7, are non-functioning and are for description only. They're simply on an automatic circuit of the book world, appearing momentarily in the text before flashing off to appear elsewhere."
He turned to the indicator board.
"If you look at the panel, our trusty old P6 Broadwood upright is currently on page 339 of The Lost World, where it occupies a space near the standard lamp in the Potts' villa in Streatham. In a few moments, it will jump automatically to the sub-basement on page 91 of Howards End, where it will sit beneath a Maud Goodman painting. A moment later, it will jump off to page 161 of Huckleberry Finn and the Grangerford Parlour."
"However," added Charles in a whisper, "Eliot, Austin and Thackeray are not only knee-deep in pianos, but working ones, which in many instances are the linchpin of a scene. And those are the ones we have to be most careful about, regarding supply and demand. Amelia Sedley's piano, in Vanity Fair, is sold at auction and repurchased by Dobbin to be given to her as a gift, and the singing and accompaniment within Austin do much to add to the general atmosphere." Thursday 5 nodded enthusiastically, and Thursday 1 through 4, for the first time that day, actually expressed a vague interest and asked a question.
Can't someone just make some more pianos?
There is a measure of economy that runs throughout the book world, he replied. We count ourselves lucky. Pianos are positively bountiful compared to the number of real dusty grey and wrinkly elephants.
How many of those are there?
One. If anyone needs a herd, the Pachyderm Supply Division has to make do with cardboard cutouts and a lot of off-page trumpeting.
The Thursdays mused upon this for a moment as Charles and Roger donned their jackets and prepared to take a few hours off while I took over. I'd done it before, so it wasn't a problem.
Everything's pretty much set on automatic, explained Charles as they headed out the door. But there are a few manual piano movements you'll need to do. There's a list on the console. We'll be back in 2 hours to take care of the whole Jude the Obscure, letter in the piano, plot device nonsense, and to somehow juggle the requirements of a usable piano in Three Men in a Boat with the destruction of Bulhoff Grand in Decline and Fall.
Sooner you than me, I said. Enjoy your break. They assured me that they would, and departed with the man in overalls, whose name we learned was Ken. Right, I said, sitting down and putting my feet up on the console. Get the coffee on Thursday. Neither of them budged an inch.
She gave you an order, said Thursday 1-4, and I take mine black and strong.
Hm, muttered Thursday 5, but she went off to put the kettle on nonetheless. Thursday 1-4 took off her greatcoat, hung it on a peg, and sat down in one of the other chairs.
So, we just sit here and watch pianos move around the book world? She asked in a somewhat sneering tone of voice.
Mind you, she usually spoke like that, so it was nothing unusual.
That's exactly what we do. Much of jurisfiction's work is like this. Boring, but essential. Without an uninterrupted supply of pianos, much essential atmosphere would be lost. Can you imagine the woman in white without Laura's playing?
Thursday 1-4 looked blank.
You don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
The classics are too slow for me, she replied, idly taking one of her automatics from its holster and removing the clip to stare at the shiny rounds. Not enough action. I'm more into David Webb.
You've read Robert Ludlum? I asked in surprise.
Most book people didn't read. It was too much like a busman's holiday.
Nope. It's Dave I like. Especially when he's Jason Bourne. Knows how to show a lady a good time and can pop a headshot from 1,000 yards.
Is there anyone in fiction you haven't slept with?
I love the woman in white, put in Thursday 5, who had returned with a tray of coffees, but with a glass of water for herself, I noticed.
All that Mozart to express her love for Hartwright? Dreamy!
I took my coffee, and we watched the lights flicker on the console as a non-functioning Bösendorfer was moved from Our Mutual Friend to Persuasion, where it jumped rapidly between the 12 different scenes in which it was mentioned before vanishing off into Wives and Daughters.
I think atmosphere in novels is overrated, said Thursday 1-4, taking a sip of coffee, before she added patronizingly, Good coffee, Thursday. Jolly well done.
That's put my mind at rest, replied Thursday 5 sarcastically, something that Thursday 1-4 missed.
Are there any cookies? I asked.
Yes, echoed Thursday 1-4. Are there any?
Thursday 5 huffed, got up, found some Jaffa cakes, and placed them on the console in front of me, glaring at Thursday 1-4 as she did so. Don't underestimate atmosphere, I said, slowly, helping myself to a Jaffa cake. The four opposing forces in any novel are atmosphere, plot, character, and pace. But they don't have to be in equilibrium. You can have a book without any plot or pace at all, but it has to make up for it in character and a bit of atmosphere. Like The Old Man and the Sea. Most thrillers are plot and pace and nothing else, such as Where Eagles Dare. But it doesn't matter. Each to a reader's own. I stopped talking because a warning light was flashing on the console in front of us.
Hmm,
I murmured as I leaned closer. They're overrunning in the Dubliners, and Ulysses needs an upright piano for Mr. Dedalus to comment upon at the Ormond Hotel in less than a minute's time.
Isn't there a spare piano at Norland Park? Asked Thursday Five.
No. Marianne took it with her to Devon, and it's currently one of those being overhauled. I scanned the knobs and switches of the console, looking for a spare piano that could be redirected. I eventually found one in Peter Pan. It was only referred to in a line of dialogue, so I redirected it into Ulysses as quickly as I could. Too quickly, to be honest, and I fumbled the interchange. Shit, I muttered under my breath.
What?
Nothing, I replied, knowing full well that no one would notice. I'd placed it in the wrong part of the Ormond Hotel. I didn't have time to worry about this, however, as another warning light was flashing. This was to alert us that the first manual piano movement that Roger and Charles had left us with was approaching. I picked up the handwritten note and read it. We've got the Getzman Grand returning from Villette, and it has to be sent with piano stool 87B into Agatha Christie's They Do It With Mirrors. Who can see a piano stool anywhere? Neither of the Thursdays moved an inch. Thursday Five eventually tapped Thursday 1 through 4 on the arm and said,
Your turn. I did the coffee.
In that case, replied Thursday 1 through 4 with impeccable twisted logic, it must have been my turn to do the Jaffa cakes.
I suppose.
Then since you very kindly undertook that task on my behalf, it's your turn to do something again. So find the sodding piano stool and stop bothering me with your bleating. I laid a hand on Thursday 1 through 4's arm and said, Find the piano stool, Thursday. She tutted haughtily in a manner that Friday would have approved of, but got up and had a look around the room, eventually finding it near a heap of sheet music, a few music stands, and a dusty bassoon. Here, she said in a bored tone, lifting the lid to look inside. Just at that moment, there was a buzzing noise, and the Getzman Grand appeared in the brightly lit aperture in the wall. Right on time. I twiddled a few knobs to set its onward journey, told Thursday 1 through 4 to put the piano stool with it, which she did, and then, with yet another buzz, I sent it on to the Great Hall of Stony Gates, inside Agatha Christie's They Do It With Mirrors. Good, I muttered, crossing that first task off the list. We've got nothing else for a half hour. But my troubles weren't nearly over, as Thursday Five had sat in the chair recently vacated by Thursday 1 through 4.
You're in my seat.
It's not your seat.
I sat in it first, so it's mine.
You can't do dibs on seats, and besides, you don't own it.
Listen, growled Thursday 1 through 4. Do you like doing crochet?
Yes, so?
Then perhaps you can imagine how tricky that might be with broken fingers.
Thursday Five's lip trembled for a moment.
I'm sure we can discuss this like rational adults before resorting to anything so crude as violence.
Perhaps we could, returned Thursday 1 through 4. But it's far easier with me telling you how it's going to be. Now, get your tie-dyed butt out of my seat.
Thursday, I said.
I can deal with this, snapped Thursday Five, in a rare show of annoyance. I don't need to be rescued like a child every single time Miss Slagfest here opens her trap.
I'm not meddling, I replied. All I want to know is where Thursday 1 through 4 got that pistol.
This, she said, holding up the small black automatic that I'd suddenly noticed she was holding. It's really cool, isn't it? A Browning 26 caliber standard single-action automatic with slide and safety grip.
Where did you get it?
I found it, she retorted defensively, so I'm keeping it.
I didn't have time for this. Tell me where you found it, or you'll be its next victim.
She paused and then said, It was in that piano stool.
Idiot! I yelled, getting up and demanding she hand it over, which she did. That's an essential plot point in They Do It With Mirrors. Why can't you just leave things alone?
I thought
That's the problem. You don't. Stay here while we sort this out, and don't touch anything. I repeat, touch nothing. Do you understand?
Yes. Yes, of course I understand. What do you think I am, a child?
I didn't have time to argue, so after telling Thursday Five to follow me closely, I jumped out of the piano squad to the Great Library, and from there we made our way into Agatha Christie's They Do It With Mirrors. We arrived at Stony Gates in the short length of dimly lit corridor that connected the square lobby with the Great Hall. We pressed ourselves into the shadows, and I looked inside the hall. It was a large room that oozed Victorian Gothic gloominess, with dark wood and minimal lighting. There were a half dozen or so people chattering, but more important, directly ahead of us was the Getzman Grand that I had dispatched not 2 minutes before. And in front of this, the piano stool, to which the weapon had to be returned. I was about to chance my luck and sneak in, but had not gotten 2 paces when a young man came and sat on the piano stool and began to play. I retreated into the shadows and felt Thursday Five grip my arm nervously as the lights flickered and went out, leaving the house in semi-darkness. We backed farther into the shadows as a large man with a sulky expression came out of the door and vanished into the gloom, muttering about the fuses. A few minutes later, an elderly woman tottered to the dining room and back to retrieve something, and almost immediately the front door was pushed violently open and a young man strode into the hall in an overdramatic manner. This was followed by an argument, the sound of the study door opening and closing, more muffled shouting, and eventually 2 shots. With the characters in the room thus distracted, I padded softly to the man seated at the piano and tapped him lightly on his shoulder. He looked up with some surprise, and I showed him my jurisfiction badge. I raised my eyebrows, placed a finger to my lips, and gestured him to join the people on the other side of the room. He did as I asked, and once his back was turned, I slipped the small automatic into the piano stool between a copy of Handel's Largo and Chopin's Preludes. I quickly and noiselessly retraced my steps to where Thursday Five was waiting for me, and within a few minutes we had returned to the piano squad's headquarters. As we re-entered, the squad room was in chaos. Warning lights were flashing, klaxons were going off, and the control console was a mass of flickering indicator lights. I was relieved to see, if such a word could be used in such uproar, that Roger and Charles had both returned and were trying to bring some sort of semblance of order back to the piano distribution network.
"I need the tumor back from Agnes Gray," yelled Roger. "And I'll swap it for a non-working striker."
"What the hell's going on, Thursday?"
It was Commander Bradshaw, and he didn't look very happy.
"I don't know. When I left, everything was fine."
"You left?" he echoed incredulously. "You left the piano room unattended?"
"I left..."
But I stopped myself. I was responsible for any cadet's actions or inactions, irrespective of what they were and where they happened. I'd made a mistake. I should have called Bradshaw to cover for me, or get someone to go into Mirrors. I took a deep breath. "No excuses, sir. I screwed up. I'm sorry."
"Sorry?" repeated Bradshaw. "That's it? You're sorry? I've got a dead Holmes on my hands. One of the Outland's most favourite series is about to unravel, and I really don't need one of your idiot cadets suddenly thinking she's god of all pianos."
"What did she do?"
"If you'd been supervising properly, you'd know."
"Okay, okay," I retorted, seriously beginning to get pissed off. "This one's down to me, and I'll face the music. But I'd like to know what she's done before I wipe the smirk off her face for good."
"She decided," he said slowly and with great restraint, "to do her own thing with piano supply in your absence. Every single piano reference has been deleted from Melville, Scott, and Defoe."
"What?" I said,
Looking around the room and finally catching sight of Thursday 1 through 4 on the other side of the room, where she was standing, arms folded, and apparently without a care in the world.
As I said, and we don't have the time or the pianos to replace them. But that's not the worst bit.
It gets worse?
Certainly. For some reason, known only to herself, she dropped an upright Broadwood straight into Miss Bates' drawing room inside Austin's Emma.
Have they noticed?
Pianos aren't generally the sort of thing one can miss. As soon as it arrived, speculation began on where it might have come from. Miss Bates agrees with Mrs. Cole that it's from Colonel Campbell, but Emma thinks it's from Mrs. Dixon. Mrs. Weston is more inclined to think it was from Mr. Knightley, but Mr. Knightley believes it was from Frank Churchill. Quite a mess, wouldn't you agree?
Can we get it out?
It's embedded itself now. I'm going to get Churchill to take the rap, and it shouldn't inflict too much damage. But this is down to you, Thursday. And I've got no choice but to suspend you from jurisdiction duties pending a disciplinary inquiry.
Let's keep a sense of perspective on this, Bradshaw. I know I'm responsible, but it's not my fault. Besides, you told me to do this, and I said I couldn't.
It's my fault, is it?
Partly.
Humph,
replied Bradshaw, bristling his moustache in anger.
I'll take it under advisement. But you're still suspended.
I jerked a thumb in the direction of Thursday 1 through 4. What about her?
She's your cadet, Thursday. You deal with it.
He took a deep breath, shook his head, softened for a moment to tell me to look after myself, and departed. I told Thursday 5 to meet me up at the CFG and beckoned Thursday 1 through 4 into the corridor.
What the hell do you think you are doing?
Oh, come on, she said. Don't be such a hard ass. There's no seriously lasting damage. So I dropped a piano into Emma. It's not like it landed on anyone. I stared at her for a moment. Even allowing for Thursday 1 through 4's supreme arrogance, it still didn't make any sense. You're not stupid. You knew it would get you fired once and for all. So why do it? She stared at me with a look of cold hatred. You were going to fire me anyway. There wasn't a ghost chance I'd have made it.
The chance was slim, I admitted, but it was there.
I don't agree. You hate me, always have, from the moment I was first published. We could have been friends, but you never even visited. Not once in 4 entire books, not a postcard, a footnote, nothing. I'm closer to you than family, Thursday, and you treated me like crap. And then I understood. You put the piano into Emma to stitch me up, didn't you? After what you've done to me, you deserve far worse. You had it in for me from the moment I arrived at jurisdiction. You all did. I shook my head sadly. She was consumed by hate. But instead of trying to deal with it, she just projected it onto everyone around her. I sighed. You did this for revenge over some perceived slight?
That wasn't revenge, said Thursday 1 through 4 in a quiet voice. You'll know revenge when you see it.
Give me your badge. She dug it from her pocket and then tossed it onto the floor rather than hand it over.
I quit, she spat. I wouldn't join jurisfiction now if you begged me.
It was all I could do not to laugh at her preposterous line of reasoning. She couldn't help herself. She was written this way. Go on, I said, in an even tone. Go home. She seemed surprised that I was no longer angry.
Aren't you going to yell at me, or hit me, or try to kill me, or something? Face it, this isn't much of a resolution.
It's all you're going to get. You really don't understand me at all, do you?
She glared at me for a moment, then book-jumped out. I stood in the corridor for a few minutes, wondering if there was anything else I might have done, aside from not trusting her an inch. Not really. I shrugged, tried and failed to get transgenre taxis to even answer the footnotophone. And then, checking the time so I wouldn't be late for the policy directive meeting, made my way slowly toward the elevators.